I said, "No, we will stick to the warped canvases," and we got them down from the wall and used them. That evening I wrote the letter to Iola, and, among other things, I asked what was the meaning of this vault face that is asking me to sit for a picture of Hypatia after doing all she could at Rochester to prevent me from getting it. 4 sheets of blank paper, marked with a private mark, were put in the letter for reply, and the envelope closed with gum. The next morning, Tuesday, March 2nd, I took this letter to May Banks, and sat with her for reply. Here are extracts from the answering letter. Regarding the messages at Rochester in regard to Hypatia's portrait, I will simply say I was influenced in my communications by Professor H. You understand. And when I was free and independent, I communicated direct. I am delighted that you followed my wish. I should indeed have been disappointed had you returned to England without it. It was simply a case of one spirit trying to dominate over another. These experiences you must not give to the world now. The time will come when all those undeveloped communications will occur. Those, J. Hudson is entirely responsible for the message given, but let it pass. I have stated that Hudson wrote a letter through Mrs. Georgia a few hours before I left Rochester, the contents of which I did not know. This letter I took to the Bangs sisters' house on March 4th, and May Bangs and I sat for an answer. The medium saw, but did not touch the letter. When I got back to my hotel, I slit it open at the top and read the contents, which were as follows. Letter from Hudson in mirror writing. To Hester and Thompson J. Hudson. Where was I born? How old was I when I died? What was my financial condition? Where is my son? What was his first name? All these things I will try and answer through the Bangs sisters. If not, let their guide tell these questions in right style, and sign the name of G. S. H. S. in full. E. H. S. are the complete initials of Mrs. Georgia. The answer. My good friend, brother, and co-worker, 78. I greet you today, and am very thankful to come to you through this influence. I find now how very little I knew when in earth form and comparison to that which is to be known. It is little things such as this phenomena that confound the mighty. I shall truly acknowledge that in my investigations here I was entirely to prejudice, sick, to be candid in certain directions. I live above these principles, sick, now, and shall endeavor to bring such phenomena in the future that shall be absolute in proof of all psychic power and the continuity of life after death. In my recent communications advising you not to have Hypatia's portrait, I was somewhat persuaded by other intelligences, as the spirit Iola was persuaded by my advice, but since I have had the pleasure of coming to you here and witnessing the wonderful power and work, and have learned all the good that has been planned, I am delighted that changes have been made, and you have the portrait. Yours kindly and ever in interest of light and truth, Thomas J. Hudson. The above is written in the same handwriting as all the replies to letters answered through the mediumship of the Bangs sisters. If these letters are juggled out of the room, and if the Bangs can read mirror writing, there is nothing in the replies so far to indicate supernormal agency, but what is written above was not all that I found in Hudson's letter. Across the second half of the last page there is a postscript, in blue pencil mirror writing, in a different hand to the body of the letter, and also to the script through Mrs. Georgia, which runs as follows. These questions, Hudson's queries in mirror writing given through Mrs. Georgia at Rochester, will be answered through the psychic power of the medium through whose hand the questions were written. Both the mediums and guides now understand. On the outside of the envelope was written, "My good friend, kindly retain the writing for yourself, for reasons I have within explained." Thomas J. Hudson. The handwriting of this afterthought appears to be the same as that in the body of the letter. I lay no stress on the curious fact that Hudson confesses to having advised Iola not to have the picture of Hypatia precipitated, as May Bangs was aware that I had received many messages from Hudson at Rochester, through whom she did not know, nor does she know today. She said, "I shall be able to tell you who that medium is," but she was powerless to do so. Mrs. Georgia and the Bangs sisters know nothing whatever of one another. While the reply was being written, May Bangs said to me, The writer of this letter has the name Thompson J. Hudson. The signature at the bottom of Hudson's questions was in mirror writing. My chief object in this chapter is to show that Hudson still lives. If, say, we do not believe in the genuineness of the Bang sisters, is there any one concrete fact in the complicated incident I have just related, which, if taken by itself, would prove his continued existence? Let us suppose that the mediums at Chicago could accomplish mirror writing of the most perfect kind. Is it possible for them to do it in such a way that, if the paper, which is the thinnest type paper procurable, is held in a certain light and at a particular angle to the line of vision, it cannot be seen? On the back of this very thin paper there is not the slightest sign of an indentation, and unless it is held in a certain way the writing on the other side is invisible. As far as it goes, this is evidence of spirit power, not necessarily that of Hudson. But there is actual proof of Hudson being present. It is declared in the postscript that these questions will be answered through the psychic power of the medium through whose hand the questions were written. Was this accomplished? If so, surely Hudson must have been with me at Chicago? Now, on March 6, the day I left Chicago for New York, Mrs. Georgia wrote a script at Rochester. Yes, this is Hudson. I came to answer my questions. I could not get en rapport with the sisters. I was born on the same day the father of my country was born. February 22, not confirmed, 1848. I have the figures wrong, it did 1834. Correct, you see, I make mistakes. I was born in a little village in Ohio called Windham. Correct. My financial condition was fair. My son has my influence and Hester is also with him. She knows him very well in his work and his name. I'm tired now. T. J. Hudson. Mrs. Georgia lost this document for 6 weeks, but told me she had received the message, when I met her in New York, on March 13, and the purport of it. Perhaps Hudson knew she had mislaid it, for when I called on Mrs. Georgia, at the house of Mrs. Bratton, in Central Park West, on that day, she was impelled to write, I am Hudson who answered the questions at Rochester. I was born on Washington's birthday in 1834 at a small country town in Ohio called Windham. My financial condition at my death was just very word indecipherable. My son's name was Johnson, or Thompson. Hudson says he did not get en rapport with the Bang sisters. That, I take it, means he could not write directly through them. But he apparently did manage to influence their writing guide, and to precipitate the message that I have called the postscript. As I have before said, the lady at Rochester knew nothing whatever, except their name, of the professional mediums at Chicago, nor did the latter know anything whatever of Mrs. Georgia. It is not possible that any communication could have passed between them. There is not a doubt in my mind that Hudson was present with me at Chicago. All the details of Hudson's life that I have been able to confirm have been found to be correct. He was born in 1834, but what date I do not know. He wrote the books he says that he did, and in the order he mentioned, he was a jack of all trades. He did practice as a lawyer in Cleveland, Ohio, and he did hold a government appointment in Washington. The name of his sister-in-law was Hester. He died, as he says, in 1903. As to the other details, I should consider myself the debtor of anyone who would kindly tell me whether they are true or not. If these lines meet the eye of any of his friends who knew the facts, I should be much obliged if they would communicate with me. I have not been able to reach his son. While taking leave in this chapter of the witty and accomplished young lady who wrote for me at Rochester, I beg to offer her publicly my grateful thanks for her kindness. She spent many a weary hour over the script out of pure good nature. What I have copied for this chapter is only about half the writing that came through her hand. Iola influenced her to write some 50 or 60 pages, which I have not transcribed, about matters of great moment to me, but could not have interested her. Mirror writing can be acquired without difficulty, but Mrs. Georgia did not learn it. No one was more astonished than the lady herself when she discovered her gift. It was all done in full light, except in 2 experimental cases. She never went into trance, and the writing was generally clear and easy to decipher. as she had never read any psychic literature. The references that appeared were of special value. Our last séance was at New York, on March 18, 1909, for the special benefit of Dr. James Hislop. Dr. Funk was also present. Mrs. Georgia had never met him before that evening, and had not read his work, The Widow's Mite. In the middle of the sitting, Dr. Funk asked a question of Hudson. "You wrote me a letter, Dr. Hudson, a few days before your death. Can you tell me to what it referred?" The reply flowed from the hand of my friend at once. It was about a little coin. I wish that my readers would refer to page 507 of The Widow's Mite to see the significance of this answer. The papers written at this sitting are in the possession of Dr. Hislop, who I believe had subsequent sittings with Mrs. Georgia. It may be put forward that a young dramatist who has so much imaginative power as Mrs. Georgia is capable of inventing, without control from the other side, the situations created in our sittings and the crude dialogues of which they form a part. I admit that such an idea crossed my mind, but it was soon dispelled when watching the facility with which she wrote from right to left. The rapidity and ease with which she accomplished this mirror writing gave no time for constructive thought. Moreover, it would have been impossible for her to invent the accurate reminiscences of Iola. I cannot account for Dr. Hudson's trick in trying to prevent me sitting for a picture of Hypatia, nor for his persuading Iola to lend her name to the deception. Probably he wished to make his message the most important feature of the account he knew I was about to write. Of this I am sure, that he desired his readers to know that he was able to communicate with the earth plane, and thus eliminate from their minds the errors he had infused into his otherwise admirable books. Let us leave it at that. I was grateful to him for giving me the opportunity of becoming his mouthpiece, and of learning firsthand the fact of his continued existence. I do not profess to understand fully all that he impelled the psychic to write, nor do I claim that he made no mistakes. All knowledge is built upon error. Astronomy rose upon the ashes of the astrology of the Middle Ages, chemistry was evolved out of alchemy. We know little, even the wisest of our day. Who can tell when a Darwin may arise to construct a definite belief out of the records of our struggles in the dark labyrinth of modern psychical research? Letter from Mrs. Georgia to Admiral Usborne Moore, Rochester, N.Y., September 16, 1910. My dear Admiral, I have much pleasure in giving you a brief account of myself, and answering your questions. I am not a spiritualist in the accepted sense of the word, neither had I, at the time of meeting you, ever inclined my faith in that direction. I believe that the knowledge of spiritualistic facts and phenomena does not in any way conflict with the religion I was born and bred in. My father, Colonel H., passed away in April. 1902. His death was sudden and unexpected, as he was in robust health until he suffered a stroke of paralysis. Our grief was the greater as we were so utterly unprepared for it. My thoughts were directed towards spiritualism by a dream. I plainly heard my father's voice saying to me, "If you take the receiver off the telephone, I will talk to you." The vibrant quality in his voice woke me, and I instantly went to the phone, fully expecting to find the dream promise fulfilled. Needless to say, there was no message, and my disappointment was keen. The dream, however, decided me to seek out the only avenue I knew, the spiritualist medium. Unbelieving, yet hopeful, I attended a lecture. The speaker, who was a professional psychic, made his way towards me and said, "You have the gift of writing." I was dabbling in literary pursuits, and thought little of this. "Come to me and I will develop this gift." The following day I sought out another medium, who told me the same thing, and that night I sat with a friend, who had been brought up in the belief of the spiritualists, in a darkened room. We sat with our faces towards the north, and chanted in unison, "We want our guides, the highest and the best." In less than an hour my hands trembled and I could not control myself. In a few moments I was in hysterics, and sobbing violently. My friend Miss W. put a pencil in my hand and soothed me by saying, "It's all right." I was, however, in a panic of fear, and when the pencil moved without my directing it I screamed, and refused to sit any longer in the dark. The lights were then lit. Though I was still very nervous and hysterical, Miss W. insisted that I should hold the pencil and not further disturb the conditions. I yielded to her wishes, and found, when the pencil was in my hand, that it began slowly to move and wrote some sentences in the usual manner, then, changing, wrote from right to left in what we thought was a foreign language. A few weeks later, when I was putting on my hat before the mirror, I saw writing in the glass, the name Jenny Rentlinger, a name no one in this house had ever heard of. Looking round, I saw it was the reflection of one of the papers I had written. Taking up the sheets, I held them to the glass, and discovered that what I had thought was foreign writing was a long, personal history of a stranger, in English, written backwards. I had kept up the writing each night, expecting that it would return to the direct style and that we should get some personal message. Curious to say, all my early script had not a private sentence in it, but referred to people of whom we had no knowledge whatever, but as the forces grew stronger, the messages became personal, and gave my mother and myself much comfort. A strange feature of this psychic writing is that I feel great reluctance to write for outsiders. Until I wrote for you, I had steadfastly refused to do much of it for anyone but my dear mother, who derived great happiness from these messages. Had it not been for her influence, I should never have continued the script, as I always felt a strange personal dread when occupying myself in this way, an uncanny and weird sensation like one feels when walking in a strange and unknown place. I have never been able to shake this off. About the fall of 1908, Mr. A. W. Moore, of this city, asked me as a favor if I would consent to write for an English friend of his who was coming to America to investigate spiritualism. Naturally, Mr. Moore wanted to show his countrymen some phenomena out of the regular channels. I therefore agreed to do what I could when the stranger should arrive. I had never heard of you, and attached very little importance to the above conversation until, in my nightly messages for my mother, there came references to the Man of the Sea. I was at this time writing a drama for the S. Brothers, and on the days when I was too indolent to go on with it, there would come a threat in the evening automatic script: unless you work on your play, we will humiliate you before the Englishman. My script was always signed Leader of the Band. On the afternoon in December, 1908, when you first called, you sent up a letter from Mr. A. W. Moore. In it you were introduced as Mr. Moore. I had an engagement, but, owing to a strong impression early in the afternoon, broke it. I could not explain why, even to myself, for I had planned it with pleasurable anticipation. As matters turned out, it left me free to receive you, and, as I told you at the time, I feel sure that some outside influence was at work to prevent me being absent when you came to the house. All goes to show there is a destiny which shapes our ends, rough hew them as we will. I was as much astonished as you were when the first of our messages were written. I had no knowledge of the various persons who wrote to you through my hand, nor of those referred to in the script. I had, indeed, heard of Sir W. C., but I had never heard of his inventions, nor that he was married. Of Professor L., Dr. Funk, Dr. Hodgson, and Mr. Myers I had not heard at all. I was aware that Mr. James had a chair of some sort at Harvard University, but of nothing else about him, nor did I know anything of Professor James Hislop, except his name, before February 1909. Of Dr. Thomson J. Hudson, who controlled me during my sittings with you, I knew this only, that some years before I had read, in a desultory manner, a book called The Law of Psychic Phenomena, written by a man called Hudson. The Christian names I did not know. I recalled the book vaguely as one I had taken up in a course of general reading. It was the only one I had ever read along this line of thought. I never heard of the Widow's Mite. Until we met, I had not heard of the Society for Psychical Research. As to Mr. W. T. Stead, I had read some of his political articles in the American, a so-called yellow journal of this country. I do not remember the subject he wrote on, and I have no recollection of his crusade against social evils. Up to the time we met, I had not seen or heard of any mediums in Toledo, Detroit, or Chicago. As a young girl, 14 years old, in 1889, I once visited Detroit, Michigan, with my parents. We stopped at the Russell Hotel, which was the best at that time in the city. You asked if I had any unusual experiences as a child. When I was 7 or 8, I saw the face of Christ, so plainly that I never forgot the impression, but my parents thought this vision was nothing but pure imagination. The first evening on which I wrote, automatically I thought I saw the outline of a woman who was a seamstress in our family, and who died just before my father was taken ill. I was never interested in ghost stories. I never learned mirror writing, in fact, never saw such a thing in my life before reading Jenny Reutlinger in my glass. I am entirely unconscious of the purport of what is written by my hand, and a strange feature is that I can never recall what it has written. Yet, if a prophecy made in the course of a script ever comes to pass, I instantly recall that I had been told in advance. Intuitively I have strong impressions. If I obey my first thoughts I am usually correct, but if I hesitate or think hard over a venture I am usually on the wrong track. I have never had such good results as I had when sitting with you, and it is my belief that you are the attracting force, and that my success was due to your guides. I cannot explain how the writing is done. I only know it is done independently of my volition. It seems to me probable that everyone has this power latent. I now firmly believe in the life after death, and in the eternal life of spirit force. I think each person has it within them to attract their own relatives and friends. I am, cordially yours, Georgia Vice Admiral W. Usman Moore, 8 Western Parade, South Sea, England. Chapter 6. Manifestations at Toledo, Ohio. The psychic riddle. I hear some of the same voices as those described by Dr. Funk. Electrical conditions in the United States and Canada in winter. The reason of the success of investigators around the Great Lakes, the Johnsons at Toledo. Opinions of a detective officer of known ability, the first sitting, materialized hands, a trumpet seance, first materialized seance, a spirit addresses me by my full name, Johnson sits outside the cabinet, medium and spirits in sight together, Cleopatra appears. John Nicholson, an abortive seance, interesting communication by Gray Eather, A.N.A. Indian, second materialization seance, 40 forms appear, identification, idiosyncrasies of each spirit form, sitting with Mrs. Johnson alone, Hypatia, materialization seance alone with both Johnsons, Iola fulfills a promise, Viola rises out of the floor, Kitty, sitting with Mr. and Mrs. Johnson in the cabinet, the illuminated robe, Kitty renounces her father, McBlin the engineer, the farewell seance, Abdullah, Tim O'Brien, dissuasion as to the possibility of fraud, members of the Council of the English Society for Psychical Research find out that there are such phenomena as telekinesis and materialization, Mrs. Alexander, etherealizations, white snow, differences in accent of American and English spirits, a new psychic in Toledo, Miss Ada Besnit, the whistling, violent movements of the table. Professor Hislop's opinion, mind reading no explanation. Readers of The Psychic Riddle, by Dr. I. K. Funk, 1907, may be interested in knowing that, through the great kindness of friends in Rochester, N.Y., I was able to sit with the psychic mentioned in that book under the same conditions as those described by its author. Since my friend Dr. Funk had his sittings, this lady had been at death's door. She was now in her 78th year, so perhaps I may be correct in thinking that, as tests, my sittings were as useful as his, though the first was a failure and the other two were cut short by Dr. Hossack, the medium's control, on account of the weakness of her heart. Much discussion has arisen over this psychic. She is very deaf. How any sane person who has heard Red Jacket or The Laughing Spirit can imagine that the voices emanate from this frail old lady passes my comprehension. Red Jacket talks as loudly as, and more fluently than, John King, the principal control of Cecil Husk. Before I attempt to describe the manifestations at Toledo, Ohio, I must remind my readers that the atmospheric conditions in the northern part of the United States are different from those in this country or any part of Europe. For about 60 days in a year, when the thermometer is down to about zero and the air is very clear, it is possible, anywhere between Rochester and Denver, by sliding along the carpet, to light a gas jet with a finger. I have not yet met any American, man or woman, who has not done this or seen it done. In this region, children play practical jokes on their parents by sliding up to them and kissing them on the cheek, when a spark passes, causing the sensation of a pinprick. We are ignorant of the causes of many phenomena, but we do know that the vibrations required to give the best results in psychical research are closely allied to those of the electrical group. It is to this highly charged condition of the atmosphere and winter that the success of investigators is chiefly due. Of this there is no doubt whatever. We must remember, too, that the original inhabitants of this vast territory were very near to nature, and were pure spiritualists. The earth is strewn with their bones, and their spirits hover about the land that was once their earthly home. We meet them at every séance, and it is reasonable to suppose that they exert some influence and assist the manifestations. In a suburb of the city of Toledo, Ohio, 632 Orchard Street, there is a two-storied house owned by Mr. Ben Johnson, a painter and paperhanger. The séance room is a large apartment on the upper floor, and is approached by a narrow staircase from the back sitting room on the ground floor. The cabinet is about 7 yards from the top of the staircase, in one corner of the room. The top of the staircase has no door. I do not know the reason of this omission, but I have been told by those who frequent Johnson's séances that one of the band of spirits who habitually frequent the cabinet occasionally gathers sufficient power to glide down the stairs and bring up a lady's muff or some other material article from the front sitting room, a feat that could not be achieved in the form through a locked door. It is, however, practically impossible for Confederates to come this way, for they would have to pass the sitters to enter the cabinet. As we shall see later on, Confederates, and plenty of them, are the only explanation that the most rabid skeptic can put forward for what goes on in this room. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson offer every facility for the sitters to search the séance room, the cabinet, and the rooms underneath. They are dependent upon each other for the necessary psychic power, and a successful materialization séance cannot take place unless both husband and wife are in good health. Mrs. Johnson sits in the cabinet occasionally without her husband, for one or two visitors. During these séances, etherealizations often takes place, and voices are heard through a trumpet. Vibrations are maintained during the materialization séances by a rather inferior musical box of the disc type, at Mrs. Johnson's cabinet séances, by a small music box of the barrel kind. Mr. J.B. Johnson is a powerful-looking man of 55 years of age, 5 feet 11 inches in height, well-educated, and of sober habits. He has a hearty laugh and a genial manner. He wears boots at the séances, and sometimes a light coat or dressing gown that enables him to be clearly seen. This, however, if meant as a precaution, is unnecessary, as the amount of light is always sufficient to admit of his being visible to all the circle during the first part of a séance when he sits outside the cabinet. His wife is a stout, comely woman, rather younger. She walks about the room, generally in a white blouse, and is always in view. The light is regulated from within the cabinet, and is sufficient to allow a person with average sight to read a watch with a white face. At times it is possible for a sitter with keen sight to read large print. Before undertaking the investigation of the Johnsons, I conferred with my friend Mr. Homer Taylor Yarian, who was chief of the secret police under the Grant government. Those who are old enough to remember the scandal of the whiskey frauds, traced by the secret police up to the very gates of the White House, will not fail to recognize the ability which contrived to defeat a well-planned robbery of federal funds. Mr. Yarian is a detective of great skill, and the last man in America to allow himself to be bamboozled. The Johnsons have given séances in his house, one of which, I possess a copy of the record, was as successful as those I am about to describe. He has watched these mediums carefully for years, and assured me they were genuine. After sitting with them several times, always in the afternoon, I am certain he is right. The first séance I had with the Johnsons was on January 4, 1909. There were three other sitters, a Mr. and Mrs. Z, and a relative of theirs, who kindly allowed me to join their private circle. Mr. Z, and I carefully examined the cabinet, and found nothing in it to arouse suspicion. The atmospheric conditions were bad, it was raining,